There's no ouzo talk without a bottle of ouzo, which is why we love the Greek Providor. Get a real taste of the very best produce that Greece has to offer. From olive oils and delicious artisan sweets, to unique spirits, earthy herbs and memorable wines. Visit thegreekprovador.com.au to see their amazing range. The Greek Providor, proud sponsors of the Ouzo Talk podcast. Craving something sweet? Head to Bay Vista Dessert Bar at Brighton Le Sands. Treat yourself to mouth-watering desserts, cakes, sweet and savory crepes, waffles, ice creams, and much, much more, all overlooking Sydney's iconic Brighton Beach. And now, also at Parramatta. Visit bayvista.com.au or drop on in for something sweet. Bay Vista Dessert Bar, proud sponsors of this episode of Ouzo Talk.
Sound is.
Nick, we are back for another episode of Ouzo Talk. How good is it to be back, mate?
We are, mate. And it's a little bit different, isn't it? We're all going remote three ways.
We are in three different places today, which, it's out of the norm for us, but I suspect it's going to be much easier to edit from my end with some cleaner audio. What do you reckon?
It will be, mate. It will be, mate. It's going to be good, especially the guests that we've got.
Okay, so look, we need to thank our sponsors before we get into it, the Greek Providor. Thank you to Crystal for jumping on board and providing the drinks for this episode. Very much appreciated as always, but you know, Nick, we've only got our guest for a short amount of time, so I reckon we should just jump straight in. What do you think?
Definitely, Tom. Let's get into it, mate.
Okay, so we actually have a returning guest today, and our guest is a retired admiral of the US Navy who led the NATO alliance as its supreme allied commander. He's an academic, an MSNBC correspondent, and an author to boot. And as we said last time, he's wanted by Vladimir Putin and the Kremlin, believe it or not. Admiral James Stavridis is back. Welcome, sir.
Good. Good to be with you. I will say immodestly, I earned 50 medals in the course of my military career. 28 of them came from non-U.S. nations. But the one I'm proudest of is that I've been sanctioned by the Kremlin. That makes me feel very good about myself.
Well, an honor. Absolutely. And let me tell you, if you haven't heard the original episode that we did with the Admiral last year, definitely go back and have a look at that, because we go into a great deal of depth and knowledge about the Admiral's past, including his roots in Smyrna, his family leaving there and, you know, sailing back into the port, you know, many years later, you know, at the helm of a multi-billion dollar warship. An amazing story. You must go back and listen to it. But look, so much happening in the world right now. So fantastic to have you with us. Nick, shall we jump into it straight away? Shall we have a drink?
Yeah, sure. Let's have a drink.
Yamas.
Cheers.
Cheers, gentlemen. Now, obviously, there is a little bit of a time difference, so we're not going to be drinking the same things on either end. I'm sure there's coffee happening over there. There's, you know, there's ouzo somewhere in the mix. But again, thank you to the Greek Providor for supplying our drinks for us. Admiral, let's start with your book, because that's one of the main reasons why you're with us today. 2054. It's a continuation of your earlier book, 2034. Can you give us a little bit of a background on what the book's actually about? It's a work of fiction, isn't it?
I can. And 2034, which came out a couple of years ago, is about a war between the U.S. and China. At the end of that war, in the year 2034, both the U.S. and China, as you would expect, are much diminished as a result of the war. So now we flash forward to the year 2054, also the title of the book. This one takes some of the surviving characters, the current geopolitics of that moment, and adds two big new aspects to the story. One is artificial intelligence. In other words, by mid-century, I think we can all agree, artificial intelligence will be a fundamental part of everything we do. Like the internet is today, if you will. And then the second thing, and I say this sadly as an American, is in 2054, in the novel, you see real conflict in America. Not quite a full-blown civil war, but a high level of conflict, troops in the street in Washington, D.C., So pretty dramatic change of tone and function and outcome in mid-century. So it's a political thriller that adds a lot of technology and artificial intelligence to the mix.
What is really the inspiration for it? Because, I mean, these are topics that are very, you know, topical, let's say, AI, cybersecurity, and whatnot. Is this something that you've been monitoring closely over the years, or has it been more of a recent occurrence for you to be interested in it?
No, I've been deeply engaged in this for decades. And the idea of 2034, war between great powers, U.S. and China, 2054, which is really the cyber, artificial intelligence, domestic politics. And there's a third book in the trilogy that'll be out in about 2 years. It's 2084. It's about climate and how climate impacts geopolitics and leads to a global war. So for a decade or more, I've been thinking about those three topics: great power, competition and conflict, artificial intelligence and cyber, and climate. And I've written these three books to kind of outline the risks that we face. And if we cannot solve these problems, we will have enormous problems going forward.
Look, I just can't help listening to your stories and the themes you've got with your books. It just takes me back to watching the movie Terminator, where they talk about
exactly.
The future and AI. But look, how much of that may be true? I don't mean the war and stuff, but how much of that stuff that James Cameron, I think he co-wrote the movie Terminator, how much of that may be true now, do you think?
I think that we're not today in 2024, we're not at the level of Terminator, but by mid-century, absolutely, there'll be smart machines who are appear like us, speak like us, inculcate our characteristics. And in fact, I would say by mid-century, we may well be able to upload our consciousness, our memories, our instincts, our reactions may be able to be uploaded exactly as James Cameron observed. If not by mid-century, certainly by the end of this century. And in that sense, this is immortality facing us. If we can be uploaded into a mechanical device, the bad news is you can't drink ouzo in a...
Damn it.
At least maybe you can. Who knows? We'll find out.
No, look, I love that theme. And even... thinking back, movies like Back to the Future, when he goes,
yeah.
I think it was the second, we go into the future and we see hoverboards and floating cars. Look, I love that concept, and I can't wait to read it. I haven't got it yet, but I will order it online. Is it online you can order it, and is it available in Australia?
Yeah. It's in English thus far. 2034, the original book, is now in 22 languages. It's been a bestseller.
Wow.
Everywhere in the Pacific, in Japan, China, on Taiwan. That's about a war with China. You can see the appeal. 2054, I think, will do very well also. And by the way, I'm old enough to remember the movie 2001, A Space Odyssey. Mm. And in that film, the astronaut is launched into space with his onboard computer, who by the end of the movie has taken over. This is HAL, who is, in every sense, what we think of as artificial intelligence today. So these ideas have been around for decades, but they're becoming more and more real. And again, mid-century, come on, that's 30 plus years from now. I think it's unquestionable we're gonna see not just smart machines, but highly intelligent at our level or greater. And that's really what the book explores.
I mean, we've just mentioned already in the course of this discussion two names: Cameron, Kubrick with 2001. Where does Stavridis sit in this in this pantheon now with this type of story?
Well, I want to add another name to the mix, and that's Ray Kurzweil. So this fellow named Ray Kurzweil, 20 years ago, wrote a book called The Singularity is Near. And what he meant by the singularity was this kind of merge of biology, cybersecurity, computer science, essentially uploading who we are into a mechanical apparatus. And his book was called The Singularity is Near. By 2054, the singularity will be here.
I think it's fascinating because I don't know if you've seen Admiral, but we had the pleasure of interviewing George Paxinos not long ago, who spoke a little bit around that sort of you know, that sort of topic as well. And he, you know, he's credited as being the man who mapped the human brain. I'm sure that there's a lot that he would think of this sort of topic. What do you reckon, Nick?
Let me just add to that. We're also seeing Elon Musk talking about implanting chips in the brain. And I think 10 years from now, you're not going to study Spanish in school. You're just going to download Spanish into your brain.
Wow, can't wait. I forget things now already. How good would that be, Tom?
I'm with you.
Think how good your Greek will be at that point.
Fluent.
Absolutely. Fantastic.
So is there going to be a movie as well? This sounds like a great story, both of them. Has anyone
approached
you for that?
Yes. 2034, we're in serious conversations with a couple of different entities. I think 2034, which is really an epic battle story between the U.S. and China, set in the Pacific, not far from Australia, obviously, really in the South China Sea, lends itself to this kind of big screen treatment. I think 2054 is more of a personality, internal, thoughtful kind of film, although it also includes a fair amount of geopolitical competition between nations that are seeking to achieve the singularity first. And by the way, some of those nations may surprise you. In 2054, the hypothesis is that Nigeria and Brazil will be leading global powers who will seek to grasp this all-important technology. Population, demographics, natural resources, geographic position, kind of all of the above. Nigeria, by mid-century, will be one of the four or five most populous countries in the world. Wow. And a dynamic, moving powerfully. Brazil, similarly, very young population. You look at countries like many European countries or Japan, populations are declining. In many ways, this is China's greatest challenge, is its demographic decline. And as you look at this kind of mid-century, 21st century, the nations that will really engage because of productivity are the ones we just mentioned, along with India, Pakistan, Indonesia. These are nations that are really going to be on the move. Demographics are destiny for nations.
Fantastic.
Fantastic.
Well, all of these topics that we've spoken about, cybersecurity, AI and whatnot, has obviously played a role in your background as an admiral and, you know, being part of the military and whatnot. How have these things changed warfare over the last few years, in the last 20, 30 years, let's say? And how important is it in this day and age? How has it changed things fundamentally?
Yeah, it's a great question, Tom. And I think we are at one of those kind of military inflection points where the addition of a new technology is going to change the fundamental characteristics of warfare. And you could point to a bunch of different moments in history. I'll give you one that's in our shared Anglo kind of background. And this is in the 1400s, the British go to France and they are taking on the Knights of France. And the Knights of France have what they think is the greatest technology of the era. They're in full armor. Their horses are in armor. And they come riding across the battlefield at a place called Agincourt, and the English longbowmen with their long arrows and their huge bows rain down arrows and slaughter them in their thousands. it's that kind of technology shift where that long range arrow overtakes armor. You can find a bunch of other points along the way where rifled projectiles and their accuracy, both in small arms and in naval gunfire in the 18th and 19th century, similar point. Obviously, the advent of nuclear weapons, thank God we haven't used them in war since the end of the Second World War, but that changed the characteristic of warfare. What is happening now with artificial intelligence will change warfare, and very quickly, I'll give you four ways it'll do that. One is maintenance. Artificial intelligence will tell us precisely when and how to get ahead of breakdowns in our high-end equipment. Number two is in logistics, deciding exactly when and where that bullet has to arrive on the front lines. When does that medical personnel have to arrive? It's incredibly complex, and artificial intelligence will fit that together. Third, artificial intelligence will become a powerful tactical actor. It'll be AI that says, look, that's the car with the terrorist in it. We're going to take it out now, as opposed to having a person in the loop. And then fourth and finally, and I'll tell you this as a commander, as a former Supreme Allied Commander of NATO, artificial intelligence will be perched on the shoulder of every strategic commander, and that AI will have constant access to every battle ever fought, every appropriate tactical decision, every disaster, all of it available to the AI. And as a commander, you turn to the AI and say, should I launch that third wave of aircraft or shall I hold them back? The AI, unlike that commander who can hold 20 battles in his mind, the AI holds every battle ever fought, the history of it.
Wow. Unbelievable.
Warfare is about to change significantly with the advent of AI.
It makes you think they might need to tap into AI as a warfare, you know, corrupt AI if everyone's going to be using it.
Absolutely. And this flips us back to something in 2034, which is cybersecurity. So AI is this crown jewel that sits inside your cyber fortress. And if the cyber fortress is cracked, your AI could become corrupted, manipulated, highly dangerous. And let's face it, we're in the very early days of all this. We really are struggling to find our way, and yet the technology is accelerating past us every second. Wow. And by the way, let me make a point here, because all that sounds very apocalyptic, right? However, AI can and probably will be an immense force for good as well. It won't be used just in warfare. It'll be used to reimagine our entire concept of medicine. It'll be used in our societies to find ways to improve logistics flows throughout our societies. It'll be used in education. And just as I said, it'll be on the shoulder of commanders. It'll be on the shoulder of doctors who are seeking to make hard, real-time decisions about patients' lives. It'll be on the shoulders of technologists who are trying to find their way to fusion reaction. So again, we're just at the beginning. It would be a mistake to imagine that it will either be only a force for good or only a force for evil. It'll be some combination of those.
It's absolutely fascinating. And I mean, look, for those listening, the book again is called 2054. Make sure you're looking it up online. I can't wait to see it. I can't wait to read it.
Definitely. And we'll have links on our show notes as well.
So absolutely.
Watch out for that. A couple of questions related to Greece and Cyprus, if you don't mind,
sure.
Admiral. First one is just in relation to the US sale of the F-35s to Greece and the Turkish F-16s and how it was simultaneous. So was there a dependency on Greece with Sweden and Finland joining NATO for US to approve the sale of the F-35s to Greece?
Yes, I think that's fair. An outside observer would say it's no coincidence that the sale to Turkey of a relatively capable jet was tied to Turkey's ultimately admission of Sweden. Let's make a point here. An F-35 is the fifth generation best fighter in the world. That's what's going to Greece. What's going to Turkey is at this point, a second tier aircraft. And that is because Turkey, under Erdogan, I think foolishly, decided to invest in Russian air defense systems, S-400 air defense system, and therefore the Turks can no longer actually be connected to NATO's air defenses. Therefore, Turkey can no longer have an F-35. So really, Turkey has fallen behind in this trade. And I'll close with this. The addition of Swinland, Sweden and Finland, yep. That's actually a good word.
Swinland. That is very good, actually.
Yeah, I just thought of that. I'm going to start using that.
You should start using it for
Swinland.
Sure.
Swinland. Swinland has joined NATO, and that's a very good thing. And the two of them, I'll have another Russo, please. And the two of them are exceptional militaries. And, you know, Turkey, you know, kind of used the situation, I think, inappropriately. I'm glad that it's Greece who's getting the F-35, and it's Turkey who's getting the consolation prize, if you will, and that's the F-16s. Upgraded F-16s.
Sure. Okay. Great. All right. Had one on Cyprus. So I read recently the UN Secretary General recently appointed a new personal envoy for Cyprus. Do you think this move reflects some willingness on behalf of the international community to gradually revive the stalled peace talk process?
Short answer, I hope so. As Greek Americans and Greek Australians and Greek Canadians and Greek XXX all around the world, we all continue to follow our homeland. And I think we all felt it was getting actually kind of close to a reasonable construct. I think about 5 years ago, 6 years ago, then it all typically fell apart and the international community moved on. But two factors, I think, are moving us toward another possibility. Number one is the growing economic importance of Cyprus, situated as it is in the midst of these massive in the regional context, gas fields. And that in and of itself creates economic incentives to kind of solve this, at this point, it feels like an interminable ongoing problem. And then secondly, the strategic importance of Cyprus because of where it sits geographically, because of its strong relationships, not just with Greece, but really with Israel, with other actors in the Eastern Mediterranean. As a nation, Cyprus, EU member, as we all know, very important. And oh, by the way, in the middle of this horrific war between Israel and the terrorist organization Hamas, and 2.2 million people in Gaza in a humanitarian crisis, the United States, the EU, the United Kingdom, the UAE, all working together to create a new pathway for humanitarian aid, which will come from the sea through a new dock that's being built so it can go directly into Gaza. Where is all that aid coming through? Cyprus. And I think this is an example of how important the island has become in today's context. And I think all of that will put additional pressure on the international system to try and solve this problem.
How do you see the unification happening? And what's a fair resolution in your view?
Yeah, I'm not going to get into that. I am not an expert on the back and forth of Cyprus. So what I do want is I do want the United Nations to get involved. I want the European Union involved, which obviously Cyprus is a part of the European Union. And I think that the Turks have been obviously problematic in this for decades, but the fact that we've resolved this membership in NATO piece also, I think, lends some credibility to how this could ultimately be adjudicated. The actual puts and takes of where borders are drawn and what parts, I'll leave that to experts on Cyprus. I am not an expert on Cyprus.
Well, look, there's obviously been a lot of news in the last few months around NATO and your good friend Vladimir Putin, let's say. I want to ask you about the Tucker Carlson interview. What did you make of Tucker Carlson actually going over there? I mean, a lot's been made of it since it happened.
Yeah, well, first of all, I think there's, in a sense, less there than meets the eye in that almost any journalist of any political stripe would love to sit down and have a conversation with Vladimir Putin. So I don't fault Tucker Carlson for taking the opportunity to go interview Vladimir Putin. What I do fault him for, if he wants to be regarded as a journalist, is that he did not ask a single hard question. He did not say to Vladimir Putin, what about the thousands of Ukrainian children that have been kidnapped and brought to Russia? What about the fact that you have invaded a sovereign country, carved out 15% of it, have documented rape rooms, torture centers, war crimes? These are happening not in Russia. They're happening in Ukraine by your forces. None of those hard questions were asked of Vladimir Putin. And I also fault Tucker Carlson as a journalist for simply allowing Putin to own the interview completely and allowing Putin to spend the first 30 minutes giving this nonsensical, historically inaccurate portrait of Ukraine as some kind of vassal state of Russia. So I don't fault Tucker Carlson for going over there. I fault him for not taking the opportunity, like a real journalist would, to ask the hard questions. He failed to do that. So don't bother listening to the interview. It's irrelevant. And Tucker Carlson, clearly not a journalist, is my bottom line.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned that half-hour diatribe that that Putin spoke about in the history lesson. You know, some sections of the media have said that giving him a platform like that was potentially giving him the opportunity to soften, to use it effectively as propaganda for his own thing. Strategically, from your perspective, is that true, or do you think it's, as you say, you know, it's less than meets the eye?
I think the latter. Everybody knows Tucker Carlson is on the Vladimir Putin train, which is to say he is not going to challenge Putin. And I think other than the fact that Putin gave him this interview, other than the fact that the interview occurred, no one in the West is paying any attention to the outcome of that interview. In other words, it's not as though Tucker Carlson has legions of people who now say, well, maybe Vladimir Putin is really on the right side of history here. I think it is not a terribly relevant event, other than it tells us more about Tucker Carlson than it does about Vladimir Putin.
One of the main things that came out of the interview itself was Putin focusing a lot on NATO expansion and using that as the excuse. What do you make of those comments? You know, once and for all, let's, you know.
I think they're complete nonsense. And I get that a lot around the circuit, which is, oh, gosh, Admiral, don't you understand that if only NATO hadn't expanded at the end of the Cold War, Russia never would have invaded? That is complete nonsense. If NATO had not allowed Poland and Romania and Bulgaria and Estonia and Latvia and Lithuania, these nations begged to join NATO. It's not as though NATO tanks rolled east and conquered these countries. They begged to join NATO. And they begged to join NATO because they had spent 50 plus years with a Russian boot on their throat. I defy anybody to open the book of history and you show me where NATO tanks conquered the Warsaw Pact. On the other hand, I can open the book of history and show you again and again where Russian tanks rolled west at the end of World War II, raping their way across Germany. In 1956, destroying Budapest. In 1968, crushing the Czech Spring. In the 70s, in Gdansk, again and again, Russian tanks have rolled west. So I don't blame any country having had a Russian boot at its throat for applying to join NATO, and I'm glad they joined NATO. And what Vladimir Putin wishes is that we had said, oh, no, no, you can't join NATO, in which case, by now, those Russian tanks would have rolled west again. Every one of those countries is thrilled to have the golden membership card of NATO. And newsflash, that's why our friends in Swinland just joined. That would be Sweden and Finland, folks. Yeah. They are thrilled to have joined NATO. We're lucky to have them. And I'll fearlessly predict tonight on Uzo Talk that, and this is not just Uzo Talk, Ukraine will be in NATO before this decade is over. Wow. Ukraine will be in NATO, independent sovereign nation, before this decade is over.
Wow. Unbelievable.
Yeah, fascinating stuff. Do you see any ramifications or any sort of response from Vladimir Putin now that Sweden and Finland have entered NATO? Do we see any change in the short term?
No. What we see, as is typical from Vladimir Putin, is a lot of bluster. And if you rewind the clock to 2 years ago, when Sweden and Finland applied to join NATO, and by the way, they applied on a Wednesday. We should have had them in NATO by Friday. Who blocked it? Recep Erdogan. That's who blocked it. Turkey blocked it. They should have been in 2 days. That was the most obvious yes in the history of the alliance. So roll the clock back 2 years, and Vladimir Putin said, there will be grave consequences if Sweden and Finland join NATO. Oh, okay. That added 600 miles of border that Putin has to defend. And in case anybody hasn't noticed, his entire army is now bogged down like the U.S. was in Vietnam. The Russian army is bogged down in Ukraine. And frankly, he doesn't have a thing to throw at Sweden or Finland. All he can do is blow a lot of hot air at them. So, no, I don't think anybody in Stockholm or Helsinki are laying awake at night worried about Vladimir Putin.
How do you see the war in Ukraine playing out now? It's been dragging on, obviously, for a while now. Where does this go from here? How's it going to end?
I can answer that in three words. I don't know. Nobody knows. It's a war. It's entirely unpredictable, and we all ought to be more humble as we assess our ability to foresee the future if the last couple of years have taught us anything. Look at the crises around the world, many of them very hard to predict. So having begun with that predicate, I don't know. I'll give you my best guess. Call this a better than even chance, maybe a 60-70% chance, in my view. I think that by the end of this year, after the U.S. elections, both Putin and Zelensky will see who the new administration is, but they will probably both be ready for a negotiation, because on the Putin side of this, he's lost 100,000 dead, 300,000 grievously wounded, 500,000 young Russian males have left Russia to avoid the draft. Putin is bleeding white. On the Zelensky side, he sees how Western support is reducing. the U.S. less enthusiastic, even Europe less enthusiastic about sending billions and billions and billions of dollars. I think both sides, by the end of this year, after the U.S. election, will be prepared to go to a negotiation. And then how does it end? Again, I don't know. I think a good model would be the end of the Korean War that both Australia and the United States fought in, which is to say you end up with a demilitarized zone. You still have an ongoing state of tension between the parties. You know, North Korea and South Korea are technically still in a state of war. They still have occasional flare-ups. I think that could be what happens. I think Putin probably ends up in control of Crimea and the land bridge up to Russia. That's about 15% of pre-war Ukraine. But the quid pro quo is that Ukraine gets NATO membership, gets reconstruction, probably using Russian funds. There's $300-350 billion of Russian money in Western banks. That money could be used to reconstruct Ukraine. I think that's the shape of a deal. Putin will go back to his people and say, look what I did. I got Crimea. I got a land bridge up to Crimea. I got this chunk of Black Sea territory. Zelensky will go to his people and say, I got us NATO membership. We'll never be attacked again by Russia, which I think is true. They were a NATO member. Putin is not going to pick a fight with NATO. I mean, just can I just do the numbers with you for a minute? The Russian defense budget is $90 billion. The American defense budget is $900 billion. It's 10 times that of Russia. And the European defense budget collectively is $325 billion. Europeans collectively spend more than three times the budget of Russia. So once Ukraine is in NATO, Putin isn't going to attack Ukraine. Not going to happen because he can't afford it. He can't fight NATO. So that's what Zelensky will say to his people. We lost 15% of the country. It's very tragic, but now we're in NATO. Now we're safe. And oh, by the way, that 15%, that's where the war has been fought. It's full of mines, missiles. It's been effectively destroyed. Let Putin rebuild that part. He can't afford to do that, by the way, and take the rest of Ukraine, the 85%, to the west and sail on. I think that's how it comes out. There's a lot of different scenarios on either end, but I think that's the main chance as I look at it.
Well, look, just one more question before you leave, Admiral. I mean, around Israel-Palestine, obviously. I mean, there are two conflicts going on in the world at the moment, and a lot of people are feeling uneasy. Media have sort of beaten it up a little bit in the sense that they throw the World War III scenario out there a lot lately. Firstly, I mean, how close to it are we? And by extension, we haven't spoken about Israel-Palestine a lot. What are your thoughts around that and feelings around that conflict?
Yeah, let's start with the fact that two things can be true at the same time. And what I mean by that is Israel was brutally attacked on October 7th by a terrorist organization that raped, mutilated, tortured, took hostages, the most awful attack on the Jewish people since the Holocaust. Therefore, Israel has responded vigorously to attack Hamas. That's all true. It is also true that 2.2 million Gazans are largely innocent of any complicity in this. They are now starving to death. 30,000 have been killed, half of them children. It is an immense humanitarian tragedy. Both those things are true. So as we look to the future, what should happen? I think, number one, we have to alleviate the suffering of these Gazans. That's why I applaud the U.S., the United Kingdom, the European Union, UAE, are all constructing a new pathway to get humanitarian aid into Gaza. You're not going to get it done dropping it from airplanes. You've got to use the sea. I can tell you that because I'm an admiral. You've got to use the sea. Once that dock is built, and I bet it'll be up and functioning within 30 days, the international community can deliver 2 million meals a day. 2 million meals a day. Those airdrops are 30,000 meals. They're nothing. Once that dock, that floating pier is in place, 2 million meals a day. That's what the Gazans need for food. And by the way, we could pull an American hospital ship up and provide a fully functioning, huge hospital right there. All that is very possible, and I think that's happening. We should do that. The Israelis will continue to fight. They are not going to have a unilateral ceasefire, in my view, nor should they. What they have undergone and what Hamas desires to do to them requires a military response. And sometimes people say to me, well, you know, it's the Israelis, they're war criminals, and this is a genocide, and they've killed 30,000. Let me tell you something. Genocide. If the Israelis wanted to kill 2.2 million Gazans, they could do that tomorrow. They could bomb the entire Gaza and kill them all. They have killed 30,000. That's way too many. They need to be far more careful in avoiding collateral damage. But they are not Hamas. Hamas is a terrorist organization. The Israeli Defense Forces need to dial it back, as President Biden says. But they're engaged in a legitimate war against terror. And both those things are true. We have to take care of the Gazans, international community. The Israelis have to take that into account. But they are going to continue the war. Final point. Gaza is 20 miles by 5 miles. It's tiny. Underneath Gaza are 400 miles of tunnels that Hamas owns. That's how Hamas trained, equipped, organized, launched, directed the attack. That's where they're hiding these hostages, the remaining 100 or so. Israel will decommission those tunnels. They'll flood them. They'll explode them. They'll block them with massive cement plugs on both sides. That has to be accomplished. That may be more important than anything else to the Israelis. That'll be part of their final steps in the military campaign. And then how does it come out? I think at that point, Israel would probably be willing to turn Gaza over to an international force, perhaps a UN peacekeeping force, an Arab League force. Israel will want to have liaisons and be engaged. But I think the Israelis ultimately are going to want to step back. They are never, I'll say it again, they are never going to let Hamas come back and operate and own the Gaza. It's not going to happen. So final thought, you asked me, what are the chances of World War III? Very small. This almost certainly will stay contained in Gaza. You'll see some sporadic, occasional ancillary conflict. Hezbollah may launch a few more missiles. Israel will strike Hezbollah. These Houthis on the Red Sea are kind of plinking a few missiles. We will smack them down over time. None of that is going to lead to World War III. And the reason is because that decision is not being made by Houthis or by Hamas or by Hezbollah. That decision will be made in Tehran by the mullahs. And the mullahs know they would lose if they tried to take on the United States or Israel or the European Union. They will not escalate this. So I think the chances are relatively high this will stay contained in Gaza. Hey, I want to shift and ask myself a question.
Please.
And that is, Admiral, we're from Australia. What's going on with China? What's going on with the U.S. and China? Is Xi Jinping going to attack Taiwan? Here, I have good news. I actually think U.S.-China relations are going to improve over the next several years, principally because China is having significant economic problems. They can't afford a war right now. Secondly, because the new administration in Taiwan, led by William Lai, who will be inaugurated on 20 May, you know, he's not trying to lead Taiwan to independence. He wants to maintain the status quo. She wants to maintain the status quo. Biden, here's a news flash, is in the middle of an election year. He doesn't want a war with China. I think as the year unfolds, U.S.-China is going to, you know, there'll be some spikes and maybe some miscalculations. I don't see that going high order. So to the degree that we want, and I certainly do, a peaceful Pacific, I think the chances there are actually not bad. I'm far more worried about what happens in Ukraine and the Middle East than I am about the Pacific, which I think will be relatively calm. So good news for Oz, good news for the U.S., good news for China, I think.
Yeah, sounds great. Well, just one last question. You sort of just touched on it. Australia invested, what, around $1 billion in killer drones in that region. What's the chances of us seeing a drone war in the near future where it's fought behind a screen?
Yeah, it's 100%. It's actually happening now. When you look at Ukraine, you see the new face of warfare, which is drones, artificial intelligence, cyber attacks, cyber security, special forces, unmanned surface drones, sinking ships at sea. Drones are coming in bigger numbers, and artificial intelligence will be able to knit all that together. But here's the really interesting thing about Ukraine. It's this curious combination, on the one hand, of World War I, trenches, tank battles, artillery duels, mud, rain, failures of logistics. It's World War I. It's the Battle of the Somme. And yet, it's also Starship Troopers. It's all the things we just talked about. I think both of those factors are going to be important, which is to say there will continue to be a component of warfare that's primal, that's primitive, that is force on force, and is about endurance and resilience. But there will also be a new and emerging set of technologies and unmanned, particularly with artificial intelligence. Back to the book, 2054, is all about how to harness artificial intelligence in the world of geopolitics. Listen, I want to conclude with something I think I probably mentioned on the last podcast, but I always say this when I'm with Australians, and I know your audience is international, Greeks everywhere, but a lot of Aussies are listening. Definitely. And I just always want to say thank you to Australia, which has stood with my nation again and again and again in the Second World War, the Korean War, Vietnam, Persian Gulf I, Persian Gulf II, Afghanistan. I would often visit the Australian troops in Afghanistan in a tough fight. You Australians have always stood with Americans. We love your country, and I just want to say thank you to Australia for continuing to sail with us, and it means an enormous amount to the United States of America. Thank you.
Wow.
Fantastic. Well, look, the book is called 2054. Admiral James Stavridis, thank you so much for being with us again. We hope that you'll join us again sometime soon. You know, whenever you like, the door is
maybe
always
for the
open.
Next book.
Yeah.
Well, I'll give you a little tipper.
Yep.
This fall, my next novel is coming out, and it's historical fiction, and it's set in the South Pacific at the beginning of World War II.
Oh, wow.
So it's the Battle of the Coral Sea, is right
so
in
Australia.
The center of it.
A lot of connections.
So Australia.
Australia. Oh, yeah.
Australia may make an appearance.
Yeah. Oh. You will see Australia in this book. So let's make a date for October, November. I'll be back.
Beautiful. Sounds great.
That's the deal, guys. Thank you so much. Efkaristo poli.
Thank you.
Ah, beautiful. Thank you.
Well, Nick, another encouraging discussion with Admiral James Stavridis. I mean, every time we speak to him, I feel as though there's, I mean, even though he's from a military background, a lot of what he says is very reassuring, isn't it?
Definitely. Look, how about some of those stories, you know? How good is it for someone like that to clarify some of the questions we ask and we hear people ask? But definitely reassuring. I like the bit that he said with World War III won't happen. We're in a good place, people like James.
UzoTalk@outlook.com is the email. Follow us on social media at UzoTalk and at @Uzo_talk. Nick Athanasiou, thank you very much, mate.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you, everyone. Bye-bye.
Ακολουθήστε μας στο Soundees, στο Spotify, στο Apple Podcasts και στο Google Podcasts.